This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Today we thought we'd talk a little bit about right view. Not wrong, right, or right, wrong, exactly. I'm going to let Shoho Roshi teach you what the Buddha had to say about this first of the Eightfold Path.
Well, first of all, I think we should acknowledge that this is a particular tender time of year. This is the end of the year. And maybe we're feeling it strongly, maybe we're feeling it just a little bit, but this is the time of year when it's common for people to reflect on their life, to recapitulate how they are, how the world is, how their relationships are, what existence itself is. This is very common, and it corresponds in a sense to the season itself, because of course we just passed the solstice. You know, this is like the longest night, the shortest day. You know, this is a time for reflection, to ask ourselves how are we doing. To actually inquire, and also, I think it will be announced later as well. But we're going to have later this week, we're going to have a New Year's celebration. So we're going to kind of, besides this reflection, this time of reflection, and understanding about ourselves, we're going to have a time when we can actually meet the future in this way. And we do it in a kind of celebratory way with bells and a potluck supper and some meditation, and everyone's invited. It's totally open if you'd like to come. But this time is very, very an interesting time, because it really is a time for us to get serious and to reflect on what our life is, what our purpose is. We understand that we carry with us enormous amounts of views, of opinions, of attitudes about ourselves, about the world, about our culture, on all kinds of things. We're like little containers of thoughts and views. In classical Buddhism, in foundationism, the way the first Buddha taught about understanding our how we think and how we carry views and how we hold views, he talked about it in a Samadhitta Sutra in a very basic way. He asked us to see things as they are, to see things realistically, not with a viewpoint of what is commonly called hedonic valence. And hedonic valence is a kind of a fancy word of saying we see we sort of assess everything in our life according to whether it's pleasant for us or unpleasant or neutral. Even our values about society, even our values about whether we're regarded well by another person or not, that's all based on this hedonic balance, this kind of judging of our life, whether it's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, or whether it's a, whether it's it sustains us or doesn't sustain us, or we don't know which, you know, something like that. So we're sort of wired, you could say, to, or we're habituated to walk around the world and assess the world and meet the world, meet other people, meet ourselves according to this kind of setup of our mental views. And that's what we're going to talk about today. It's quite important for us to see it, particularly this time of year when we're very reflective, we're very internal, very reflective, and we're looking forward to the next year. So our guiding teacher, Nenzen, is going to guide us in how to see what is called, what the Buddha sometimes called right view. But right view, the word right view is a little problematic, because the moment we say right, we set up right and wrong, good and bad, you know, those kind of dualities. The term samyak, the actual Sanskrit word samyak, is translated as, often commonly translated as right, but a more complete translation would be a completed or fulfilled or realized view. What we might even say, like a realistic view, a real view, you know. So Nenzen is going to expand and guide us in what this idea of right view is.
So when I first came to Jikoji, how many of you, is this your first time here? Me too. When I first came to Jikoji, there was a resident living here, Ben, who's become a dear friend. His name is Hogan. And you might remember this, Chuck. I didn't know his name. I hadn't met him. It's my first day here. And every time I saw him on the paths, he worked, I was working, everyone was moving, of course. Every time there was another body in his view, it didn't have to be me, it could be anybody. He would stop, please stop on the path. Remember this? He didn't know me from anybody. I didn't know him from anybody. I thought it was pretty curious because, you know, we're both moving around campus, and every single time, all day, 2 days in a row, full stop. Just complete recognition. Some of you who are in beginning meditation heard this gassho. I taught you a little bit about your hands together in gassho. But every time he did this, of course, I felt absolutely stopped in my tracks. You can't keep going when someone's doing that. And of course, I bowed gassho back. Later, I found out that this was his then practice of remembering to recall that everybody, everything he encounters is a Buddha. And that experience has stayed with me. He no longer gassho bows to everybody he meets everywhere. He lives in Iowa and Oakland. It would be exhausting to do that all the time. But I don't think he stopped doing it. It's become an internalized, integrated practice with the way he moves through the world, right? Everybody's a Buddha. It was a great gift to me. And I think, of course, it was a gift to himself. Practice that way. This gassho bow becomes one. It becomes one, and then it spreads out from everywhere. This expression of recognizing someone and receiving them, this time together, this very singular moment, and then it's gone. It's very affirming to everybody. Maybe even the trees are bowing back. So I find myself doing this. Of course, I live here, so it's pretty common to be gassho bowing, but You know, if I find myself doing this at Trader Joe's and a little embarrassed, or when someone, you know, lets me cross in the crosswalk, they stop their car in Los Gatos, and I find myself recognizing, being recognized, having this mutuality of a moment together. And often little kids in strollers, you know, you make that contact, there's no words, and you want to bow. So this gassho, expressed with hands together. How about if everybody just does it for a minute? You can see it's kind of a reflection of our hearts, right? Hearts and our minds together. And for me, this is an expression, one way of expressing right view. So these two hands together are holding me and everything else, the whole world. The individual, this, whoever she is in any given moment, and be infinite. Everything that ever happened and everything that's ever going to happen is all right here. When you stop on the path of your own life and take a bow to what's right in front of you. So any kind of hand position in our practice is called a mudra. Mudra. It's technically defined as a seal, like a stamp, or a mark. The term I really like is a gesture, because of course we are gesturing with our bodies all the time. And I like this intentional gesture. And the mudra, this mudra is called gassho, which literally is defined as placing the two hands together. Duh. But the founder of our temple, Kobun Chino Otagawa Roshi, had a very expansive view of most, maybe everything. And this is what he said about gassho. These are his words. Mudra, your hand position, whatever it might be, means identity, the appearance of form, color, and shape, along with your recognition of a flower or a candle. Together, that makes an identity. In the mudra of a jolly, or in Japanese, gassho, with palms together, all kinds of dualism, man and woman, past and future, parent and child, teacher, student, they all come together in front of you as you bow. The hands fit together perfectly. So they must have been one before. Otherwise, such identical opposites could not exist. Teacher and student are not different entities, but one. So they can feel each other, touch each other. A person is like that. By being separated, you cannot feel the beginning place. When you touch your cheek, you feel, yes, this is a cheek, and it is a hand, both, as if from a blind state. This is both an intimate and independent practice. This life in such a lost state, touching is very important. Being recognized by someone, recognizing someone without destroying the other, is a very, very important subject. So how do we do that? How do we recognize ourselves and the other without destroying, without doing harm? Kobun teaches us that it's important that we touch the intimate and independent experience. How do we do that? How can we express this and receive this without causing any harm? One way of looking at this is through the lens of what is wholesome and what is not wholesome. In practical terms, we might say, in practicing with right view, we pay attention to our individual causes and conditions. One hand. Pay attention. And then we also pay attention to the wholeness that includes this, you, everything throughout time and space. Both hands. We pay attention to that which brings out the best in ourselves and therefore in everyone, wholesomeness. And we pay attention to that which does not do that, which hurts us, therefore hurts the whole fact. When we can be brave this way, we can be here together, intimate and independent. When we're willing to receive information and feedback and mirroring about this, our own unique causes and conditions, our responses and reactions that come from this unique this, and also zoom out and recognize that it's not all about us. We let in entire experience of wholeness, all of you, everything that brought you here and your ancestors' entire lives that brought us here together today. We can naturally touch this intimacy, this mutuality of experience without destroying it, without having an opinion or a judgment or an assessment or a view, but listening, paying attention to the wholesomeness, both hands together. That would be a right view. That would be an expression of a wholesome way of being in each moment. Being this, whatever, whoever she is in any given moment, and recognizing this inseparably from this can't be separated. At least we understand that we have an opportunity there in that intimate space to be skillful and make an informed choice about what we're going to do with this moment of our lives. Very practically, when we stop ignoring what's here and here, and stop defending me, when we honestly engage with what's here right now, we have this great opportunity to be alive in our lives, right here, right now. We can kind of stop suffering, shockingly, in each little tiny opportunity like that. So say more about the Buddha's teaching. Say more about the Buddha's teaching on right view.
He said, right view. Something that came to mind when you were talking is to have this view of wholesome, have a wholesome view. Sometimes we need to precede it with a little reflection and analysis, like what has been wrong view within us. So when we meditate, obviously what we're doing is this is a kind of concentrated thing that we're doing. And we deliberately simplify this situation that's quiet and still so that we're able to see the actual presence that Nenzen talked about, the present moment. We see when we meditate, what we have, the only thing we have is we don't have our phones. You know, I mean, I know everybody walks around with their phones and all the media. All we have is this body and this mind at this time. this body and this mind at this time. So when we meditate, it's kind of challenging. It's kind of a work because we actually have to look at our mind, our body in this present moment. And we see, most of us see, I still see how prolific my mind is, how creative my mind is, how my mind is always telling a story. It's always, not always, but commonly coming up with commentary, 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 assessment, like you said. So activity for us in meditation is to see our minds as they are, to see our mental production. They actually call it fabrication, like something is created. It's fashioning or fabricating. We're creating a world. We're creating the story of me in relationship to the world. Each of us is doing that individually. And there's some collective activity going on that has to do with culture and social agreements and so on. But individually, we have our own little storyline going. And when we meditate, we have an opportunity to actually see that, to study it like a scientist, in the laboratory is studying consciousness. Sometimes they say, it's kind of a joke, but they kind of say, a meditator is a connoisseur of consciousness. He's studying consciousness itself. He or she is studying not the contents of consciousness, not the story itself, but consciousness itself. So this is our activity when we meditate. So to have a wholesome view, as Nenzen said, to develop this wholesome view that expresses itself in a gassho, or in how you relate to one another, we do need to study how we're doing. We do need to kind of, like a scientist, like a detective, you could say, we need to study our mental states and see how we're doing. We do have habitual patterns of how we think about, we have what's called, in the Metta Sutra, you heard the term fixed idea. We do have certain ideations or ideals about who we are or how the world is that are fixed, and it's real and they're rigid in us. And we have to see that. We have to look at that. And part of the meditation is we look at that and we see that in the reality of just being with our body and mind, that fixedness starts to dissolve. It starts to get soft. It starts to get compliant. And compliancy, when the term compliancy means not just that you roll over and play dead. Compliancy means that you're flexible, that you're able to be taught. You're able to receive something. You become able to receive. So with the meditation, we become soft and we're able to see our mental production and we're able to release it. And it's a relief, I have to tell you, because this is the joy of practice is this relief of this mental production. And so this is the work of coming to right view. And this is our practice. And our right view is not only releasing fixed views, but it's also kind of expanding the view. So Thich Nhat Hanh said, when he talked about interbeing, he said, it's like we're walking in a woods. We're walking in a woods and there's a tree and a tree and a tree and a tree and a tree. And we identify that we're in a woods and there's tree and tree and tree. And he said, this broader view, this arrayed view that Dogen talks about, that sees all the mountain, the whole mountain range, this arrayed view is like coming out of the woods and walking up to a kind of hilltop and seen the whole forest. So that's a fruit, that's a fruition process of right view, is that instead of having this narrow, tight view about us and me and my issues about the world and people, we can get up on this hilltop and we can see the whole picture. We can see that there's a cause and effect. We can see that there's that I'm conditioned, that the other issue that we're meeting is also conditioned. We can see that they're related. We can see that there's no separation.
Shoho just mentioned Dogen. Dogen is the founder of Soto Zen. And Okamura Roshi, who is a scholar of Dogen, 12th century Dogen, he has characterized this practice that we do as seeing one reality, one whole, from two sides, and then expressing the two sides in one action. So one reality that you can see from your view and from this zoomed out view. And then you manifest, you express your relationship with this whole thing with your action, one action. Okamura writes this: living fully in this intersection allows us to understand impermanence and still grieve when a favorite cup breaks, to understand interconnectedness and still take responsibility for our individual actions, and to understand that there is no I, while still appreciating the unique personal qualities of ourselves, of our friends, of our family. We can't get so caught up in emptiness and non-duality that we fail to notice the difference between a red light and a green light, or between medicine and candy. Neither can we become so narrowly focused on our own day-to-day activities that we fail to notice that they're part of the functioning of the entire universe as a whole. So the question becomes, in each little tiny moment of our lives, do we have the courage to meet it as it is? To develop our self-understanding, our causes and conditions. To respect and acknowledge that you have yours too. And that we're meeting in this fabric everything. So here's a little exercise that spontaneously arose when I was absolutely not thinking during Zazen one morning. I sat down and, like Roshi and like all of you, sometimes thoughts come and our feelings or perceptions or impulses and memories and all sorts of things. So I had this experience that I'm going to share with you, and then you're going to play along, I hope. So sitting here in the dark one morning in the small zender where the residents sit every morning and evening, I noticed an emotion. Let's call it sadness, grief, you can call it anything, worry. And rather than grabbing it and saying, oh, my story about it, right? And rather than trying to kill it, I don't want that thought, get rid of it, why do I have to have this? None of that, right? I watched it and I wrote a little gatha. Now, you just actually chanted a gatha, the gatha on opening the sutra. It's like four lines typically. And we'll chant another one when we're done with this talk. So spontaneously in my Zazen, I did a gatha. And this is the first one I did. As I observe this worry, I vow with all beings to receive its wisdom and to release my grasp for the benefit of all beings. I did that for every idea, opinion, emotion, fantasy, memory, shame, guilt, loss, joy, happiness, hunger, craving, whatever arose. I did it for a few minutes. And of course, they all just evaporate. When you don't grab them or try to kill them, they just release you as you release them. So the effect of this for me was a gusho, right? I accepted this person, this, whoever she is in that moment, and I accepted this. Because in the gatha, we are recognizing that we are vowing with all beings, because all beings experience being human, or being a tree, or being a rock. They are experiencing their experience. And then we receive its wisdom, and we release our grasp on it for the benefit of all beings. And by the way, the benefit of all beings is me too. If I can recognize this intimate moment and also release a grasp on it, meaning wanting it to be different, either wanting more or wanting less, it benefits me. And guess what? It benefits you. It benefits the whole world because of interbeing, as Roshi mentioned. None of it arises in a vacuum. Nothing arises without connection. So when we accept, in my case, this expression of gatha, I did it for a few moments and then I didn't have to do it anymore. We get a little bit of an awareness, right? This kind of kind awareness of our own causes and conditions. And we recognize our suffering doesn't belong to just us. And we vow to be with it, to be wholesome with it, to do something healthy in response. And in that space, compassion flows in like the ocean, absolutely flows in like an ocean. You feel compassion for you because, yeah, you're having this experience. And you then feel compassion for everybody in the whole world that's ever existed and is still existing and will soon not exist, because they're having their experience too. And it's not so different. So that is an expression and an experience of being intimate with just what's here, being with it, not grabbing it, not trying to kill anybody who has that experience, and being okay no matter what arrives. So I said I would like you to play along. Don't be afraid. It's just play. And I'm going to make the first line of a gatha. And I want you to not try to like be a good Zen student, okay? Don't try to get a right answer. Just say your own experience when I give you an opportunity. And you could maybe gassho before you say it, so you don't all say it at the same time and I'll point at you or something like that, okay? So we're going to make a few gathas together based on your experience right here, right now, or even maybe from your meditation period this morning. As I observe, fill in the blank, some feeling, experience, thought, anything that came up for you. So your turn. As I observe.
Rain is dropping. Wind is blowing, truth are breathing.
I vow with all beings to receive its wisdom and release my grasp for the benefit of all beings. As I observe,
regrets.
As I observe my regrets, I vow with all beings to receive their wisdom and to release my grasp. The benefit of all beings. As I observe,
my judgment.
In my case, plural. As I observe my judgments, I vow with all beings to receive their wisdom and to release my grasp for the benefit of all beings. Anybody online? Dear ones out there? Yes. As I observe, go ahead, Mandy.
As I observe, it is changing.
Oh. As I observe, it is changing. I vow with all beings to receive
it
and release my grasp for the benefit of all beings. Anybody else online? I don't want to ignore you guys and gals. Tova-san, as I observe,
recent fear.
As I observe recent fear, I vow with all beings to receive their wisdom and release my grasp for the benefit of all beings. Okay, last chance, folks online. Anybody else? Akbar, is that you? Yes, good. As I observe,
this little guy in my head is just driving me crazy. Yeah. The chatter in my head.
As I observe, the little guy or gal in my head
right.
is driving me crazy. I vow with all beings to receive its wisdom and release my grasp for the benefit of all beings. Koban called that the little policeman. Right? Okay, you peeps, your turn. As I observe, sorry?
An upset friend.
As I observe an upset friend, I vow with all beings to receive that wisdom and release my grasp for the benefit of all beings. Anybody else?
As I observe, nothing comes.
As I observe, nothing comes. I vow with all beings to receive that wisdom and release my grasp for the benefit of all beings.
My observe me disappears.
Sorry?
Me disappears.
Me disappears as I observe me disappearing. I vow with all beings to receive that wisdom and release my grasp on even the disappearing for the benefit of all beings.
I observe your smile.
As I'm sorry?
Your smile.
Your smile. As I.
Takes one to know one.
Yes. As I observe your smile, I vow with all beings to receive its wisdom and to release my grasp for the benefit of all beings.
As I observe the spaces between people, is also the non-space between people.
I vow with all beings to receive that wisdom and release my grasp for the benefit of all beings.
Yeah. I observe the fixed mindset.
As I observe a fixed mindset, good for you. As I observe my fixed mindset, a fixed view, I vow with all beings to receive that wisdom and release its grasp for the benefit of everybody. As I observe my fabrication of my life stories.
See, everyone relates to that. As I observe my fabrication of life stories, I vow with all beings to receive the wisdom and release my grasp for the benefit of all beings. So the purpose, we can keep going. Does anybody else really have a burning one? It's like, gotta say it. Yes.
As I observed the unknowns and the anxiety around it.
Oh, baby. As I observed the unknown and the anxiety around it. Yes, ma'am. I vow with all beings to receive that wisdom and release my grasp for the benefit of all beings.
I observe the wars and the suffering caused by the fingers of all people.
As I observe the wars caused by the anger and the suffering of all people, I vow with all beings to receive that wisdom and release my grasp for the benefit of all of us in our little sweet planet.
As I observe all consequence.
As I observe all consequence, I vow with all beings to receive its wisdom and release my grasp for the benefit of all beings. Okay, anybody else? Anybody online? Going, going, gone. Not gone, of course. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I hope you can carry this around in your pocket in your life so that in any given moment you can remember that it's all together all the time. And to the extent that you have to separate yourself, first of all, it doesn't work. And second of all, it's suffering to separate. But if you, you know, use these gathas just like a little, another little toy in your toy chest, you can see what's arising and you can maybe accept its wisdom, accept its teaching. It's all coming from you and everything else. So it's a very incredible opportunity you have because you encountered the teachings, which is super rare, and because you have an opportunity, and in my view, responsibility to yourself and to the whole world to be wholesome about it. So this is a chance to do have a few minutes, yeah, to ask questions. You can ask about what we spoke about today. You can ask about Buddhism. You can ask why it's raining, anything you like.
How to control my mind during meditation? I can't keep thinking of something else.
There's two ways. Mm-hmm. One is called a right-hand path, and one is called a left-hand path by a teacher named Katagiri Roshi. And the right-hand path is a path of internal discipline. The left-hand path is a kind of expansiveness where you allow everything in your mind, every thought, every emotion, every sensation to be part of practice. You actually, instead of assuming that it's separate from practice, you assume that it is part of practice, or you make it part of practice. So a pain in your knee, a thought, a kind of running commentary in your mind. When you notice that, you in a sense absorb it as practice itself. That's the left hand path. The right hand path is a path of actually disciplining the mind, taming the mind. Chochen, it's called. It's you tame the mind. And one of the prescriptive and common ways of taming the mind, probably this teacher showed you in meditation practices, you have a focus that helps you bring your attention back. And the most common one is the breath, the natural rhythm of your breath. So even though you're thinking, you just come back to your breath. You come back to your breath. Come back to your breath. And it's taming, or like training your mind. So if your mind is wild, or if your mind is flooded or full, you can just bring it back, like training a puppy, you know, to train a puppy, you have to be very disciplined, and you have to be very regular. You have to train that child or that puppy to not pee on the rug or whatever the puppy's doing, you know, and slowly the puppy learns, and slowly the mind learns how to come back. So that's the right hand path. And the left hand path is where you could say you're in meditation, you're generous. So everything is meditation. Even your distraction is meditation. So you can try that either way. Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You mentioned being soft and receptive to things, but
being soft and receptive to things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wonder how does that like work when facing kind of like a harsh world? If your softness and compassion doesn't receive well in kind of like harsh reality.
Well, you want to say something?
Well, I have that experience a lot. I err on that edge. And I allow myself to feel what I'm feeling, to experience, because for me, the other side of that feeling of harsh, the world is harsh and it's not so kind, and my kindness meeting, it's an expression in a way of caring for yourself and for all beings. I don't think that's something bad to care. It just means you're going to have to recognize that you have to kind of be okay in the midst of that and do your part to go forward.
There's a mythic deity called Avalokiteshvara. I think it's mostly a feminine deity. And because this person had so much compassion, she was able to hear the cries of the world. She developed, you've probably seen this, she developed many hands to take care of people.
Like a thousand arms?
Yeah, a thousand arms. And she had many heads, so she could see and hear in all directions. So she kind of became, you know, this sensitive person who absorbed the suffering of the world. So to see the world as harsh is a view, of course, and whether it's harsh or not, it's still a view, you know. But how to receive it, you know, how to receive that harshness without boundaries, without edges, that's the important thing, you know. The edges, the boundaries are the world, me. If you can dissolve that boundary of me and the world and see the suffering of the world as my suffering, and see my suffering as the world's suffering. In other words, to see suffering as not personal, but universal. Then you'll appropriately respond to whatever, you know, whatever conflict is going on outside you, or you'll meet whatever has to be met with appropriately, because, you know, there won't be any separation. You'll be connected with it. So, okay.
And you might grow more heads and more arms. You'll be okay.
Yeah. And then you have a big job.
What hat to wear?
Yeah, I have a question. So how I kind of feel very peaceful today, but how to maintain that during a very busy work and life?
Throughout your life?
Yeah, how to maintain that, how to keep it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of teachers that have little mnemonic devices or cues to help them throughout their life to remember this kind of gift of mindfulness or attention that we have when we do this deliberate meditation. So there's a teacher named Thich Nhat Hanh who throughout the day he'd ring a little bell, and everyone would just stop and take a deep breath and remember presence, just pure presence without any discrimination. There's some people that every once in a while throughout the day might have a little special place where they offer incense and just remember their intentions or their presence throughout the day. I for a while I was doing a practice where I would try to remember to notice the spaces in between my thoughts, the gaps in between my thoughts, the space in between my thoughts. And I would like, when I noticed the non-thinking self, the wu-wei thinking, you know, the spontaneous self, the natural self that's before fabrication, when I noticed that little gap, I would feel a sense of connection and relief. And so throughout the day, you can kind of cue yourself to just kind of check in like that. Just remembering your breath. Some teachers say, throughout the day, you're busy, you're on the phone, you're doing this, you're doing that, you're thinking about this, you're thinking about that. And you remember to remember, so to speak. And you just take one breath, just one inhalation and one exhalation with mindfulness, with awareness. Just try that. I think that's the best one. Okay. Yeah. But you might invent your own, you know, you might invent your own special way of checking in. Yeah. Yeah.
And I want to suggest that you not punish yourself if it's difficult sometimes to return right now. Be kind. I think I heard the bell. I'm sorry. Okay, one more.
Well, I always find myself with these vows of saving all beings and all these things. I understand the compassion inherent in them, but I also find myself feeling an edge of ego to them. And I'm just wondering about how you, if you have any thoughts on, you know, this like this mandate to be kind to everyone and save everyone, that feels the interplay of like humility of that versus the ego of feeling like you can save everyone, you know.
You were a good boy or girl or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, there's no saving anybody. But it makes a big difference how you approach your life. We're not practicing. There's nothing, as I said to Jean Ho, there's nothing holy about this. Nothing holy about this. I didn't make that up, by the way. Bodhidharma did, the guy with the big eyes out there. Nothing holy, but at the same time, everything is sacred, I would say. So
you know, there's no puffing up of you and trying to vow with all beings to help all people. I mean, there's no you that's separate from all those beings. So I don't know how you create that kind of, I'm sure people do. I'm sure they do. I've seen it. I know they do. But that's not what we're doing. That's not our intention. And you're all beings. So I don't think it's about, maybe you should take out the I in that phrase. When you saying I vow with all beings, just take out the I part. Vowing with all beings. See if that's a little softer. There's no, you know, I can barely take care of me. And on a given day, not so well. So I'm not going to save all of you. You got to do that for yourself. I can't do that for you. But at any given moment, we can hold hands, right? And walk down the road together, like Hogan, bowing to each other.
Let's bow together.
So we're going to do the gatha on.
It's on page two, our closing gatha. This is on three. Three. Okay.
May our intentions equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Being star numberless, I now save them. Illusions are inexhaustible. I have to end them. Dharma gates are numberless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is impossible. I vow to complete. So, please, let's put the room all back together. And then just stand at your cushions and we'll bow to each other, okay? Bye, friends. Thanks, Michael. Hi, Jackie. Bye. Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.